WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's start the July 4th weekend off with the master of funk, George Clinton. It's part of our holiday archive edition of Fresh Air. Funk began with James Brown, but it was Clinton who was responsible for many of its innovations in the 70s and 80s. He brought electronics into his rhythm tracks and used a guitar sound inspired by acid rock. Rock critic Ken Tucker called Clinton's lyrics aggressively vulgar and brilliantly literate. Clinton created a funk empire, which included Funkadelic, P-Funk, The Brides of Funkenstein, and other incarnations. In the 70s, he put on extravagant stage shows that incorporated science fiction plots and elaborate mythologies. A lot of today's hip-hop performers have sampled or otherwise paid tribute to Clinton's records. Clinton's next record is scheduled for release in September on Prince's label. I spoke with Clinton in 1989 when his album The Cinderella Theory was released. Here's the title track. That Cinderella Theory, the title track from George Clinton's new album. George Clinton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Yeah, I just got defleed and got the ticks off of me. I got my doggy bag, and I'm going to go get my rabies shots, and I'll be ready for them. How you doing, baby?
Okay. What got you back in the studios and on the road after 5 years?
Oh, I got tired of laying up being an old dog and not learning new tricks. So I said, let me get back out there. Because, you know, when rap started getting heavy like it is now, I said, that's an old trick right there. I can do that. So here I am back out here talking stuff.
How do you feel when a rapper uses one of your rhythm tracks on one of their
records? I love
it.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, the ones that use too long, they pay.
And right.
The rest of them keep us alive. I mean, like, who's it? Me, Myself, and I.
Right, yeah.
That particular one, I'm glad they did that one because, I mean, it brought my whole thing back to life. Plus, they paid good.
Mm-hmm.
De La Soul, the company paid real good. But the main thing is that it brings you back to life if you know how to use it. Like, they did it with James Brown, too. And what I did and I learned from him was that I didn't get upset. I figured out a way to benefit from it. So I sample my record back off of this and some of this.
Well, I'd be curious in hearing about what music you first heard that made you want to make music yourself.
Oh, wow. I can almost tell you precisely what it was. It was Why Do Fools Fall in Love?
Frankie Lyman.
Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. I was about 13. I started Parliament probably a year later. Right around the same time. So Parliament's been around since about 56. But that was the record, Why Do Fools Fall in Love. And The Spaniels, of course. Most people would know nostalgically Good Night, Sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
Good night, sweetheart, well, it's time to go. A lot of people remember that one. But I remember some of their earlier doo-wop records. And they were the ones that actually made me want to, excuse me, you know, to really get into it. And plus, you know, in Newark, New Jersey, where I grew up at, everybody either sang or boxed or played ball. I tried boxing. That wasn't happening. I played ball. You know, I had a team, baseball team. They kicked me off my own team. So then I got my group together, and that's been working pretty good ever since.
Well, at the same time that you were singing with your group, The Parliaments, you were also running a hair salon, right?
Well, that was later on. I started the Parliaments in 56. By 59, I was working in a barbershop, you know, processing hair. You know, that go right along with the doo-wops. You know, you get your hair done and you go stand on the corner and sing all day and night.
Mm-hmm. Let me get back to when you were in the barbershop and you were conking people's hair. How were you wearing your hair at the time?
Conk, too. How did you know that phrase? You ain't supposed to know that phrase. That's the inside phrase. Conk is a real old one. That's what it was, though. I was wearing my hair the same way. Matter of fact, there's pictures around with, you know, hair slick, looking good, you know, waves. Make you seasick to look at my head. But it all worked real good for us because everybody in the band worked in the barbershop at that time.
Was style very important to you then?
Styles?
Mm-hmm. Was style very important, being stylish?
Style has always been important. That's why I think we are able to survive so much now. I can see styles coming long before they get here, and I can pretty much tell what goes with the style. So as I see it approaching, I try to jump into it early, and I can divorce myself from any previous styles as that being the only style in the world, which is what a lot of people have trouble doing, because the industry will tell you that ain't your bag, and you get trapped in a style or a setting. But having worked in a barbershop, styles was for, you know, fit faces or fit the time, if it was Easter or Christmas. You had all kind of styles that you could relate to. And like I said, faces. So you had a lot of variety of styles to appreciate. So I transferred that into music. And my whole life has been like one big style after another. And it all looked like, wow, look like he's been doing that all his life. You know, I forget that I have hair like I've got now. When I see somebody looking, I don't get upset because that's what I do for the attention. But I forget because it's so natural.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to play the first hit that you had back when your group was called The Parliaments.
Oh, my God. Ooh, luscious. You know, that was a big record in Detroit. That record broke right here in Detroit. I was back at the barbershop and giving up for a minute.
Well, here it is, George Clinton's first hit back from 1967, I Just Want to Testify. From 1967, that's George Clinton, The Parliaments.
Well, it sounds good to hear that again.
Yeah, it sounds really good. You were saying that when that record was a hit, you were working for Joe Bett, the publishing company of Motown Records. I once read you say that there was a lot you didn't like about Motown. You didn't like the idea of everybody in the group dressing alike and doing the same steps.
Not that we didn't like it. We loved it. But we just couldn't see ourselves overcoming the temptations or the pips. First of all, the temptation was from here, and the criteria for that, you know, at that time was height, you know, 6 feet. Matter of fact, they all were 6 feet. And we were like 5, 6, 2, 3, you know, we was all over the place. It wasn't uniform. And the routines and things we had perfect. And the suits, of course, we had perfect. And the styles was perfect. But there was no way to outdo the Pips with the routine. They were the best routine and group that I've ever seen. And the Temptation had the perfect image, plus this was home for them. So it wasn't that we didn't like it. It was just no way for us to overcome the competition within the company. So we just threw the suit. And plus, it was hard to keep ties alike or shirts clean. Anyway, that was the hardest part of all. And so it was convenient when we realized that hippies and rock and roll and blues was the exact opposite of what we had been into all our life, because we could do this having fun. We'd wear the clothes bag as opposed to the suit. We take the suit out and throw it down and cut holes in the clothes bag and put it on. You know, and it became just a big joke at first. But the music was always, like, very soulful, churchy, you know, like Maggot Brain, psychedelic. You know, nobody had seen black groups doing psychedelic. They used to call us Temptations on Acid or James Brown on Acid, you know. But it always worked. And so we just, you know, changed our whole thing and went that way. So it wasn't that we didn't like the routines and things. It's just that it was convenient for us to go a different route.
We're featuring a 1989 interview with George Clinton. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to an interview from our archives with George Clinton. You were just saying that people used to call your group the Temptations on Acid. Were you doing a lot of acid yourself during that period? And what, if so, what effect did psychedelics have on the kind of performances and stage shows you wanted to do?
Of course, you know, at that particular time, everybody did acid, mm-hmm. you know. And I did my share and two or three other people's share, probably. But at the time, I wasn't into equating it or analyzing it as it being the thing that helped us, even though later on, after I felt safe enough distance from that whole era, you know, and I love the era, but, you know, once you start to seeing that it was over, you start being afraid, then you say, oh, I made it through that. Then I realized that, okay, it did break me out of that mode of the streets of New York, New Jersey, the rat race that tend to make you feel like I got to do it to them before they do it to me. It definitely helped us all from that particular, because we was growing up into that, and that's what we would have been.
Since your music was inspired both by soul and funk, but also by acid rock, I was wondering if it was ever hard to kind of get accepted by both black and white audiences.
Both black, we could help with both black and white. You know, we was too black for most white audience, because there were so many of us. They could take Jimi Hendrix and, you know, the couple white guys, but here you had 10 guys up there acting all like they were from, you know, Newark, and we were. But it was all in fun. I think that one kept us alive for part-time, and then the other one kept us alive, you know, as far as surviving. There was a core or cult following of, say, Maggot Brain fans or white fans from Boston, Toronto, parts of Michigan, you know, and Cleveland, in all the colleges, we had a good audience. And then towards the 71, it started being like a lot of black. We did America East is Young. A lot of the black audience started showing up. And by the time we did Cosmic Slop, it was really both, you know, but both wouldn't come to the other show. So we still had to do different places altogether.
Since you've done some barking for us already on the show, I thought I'd play Atomic Dog, which is one of the hits under the George Clinton name.
Yeah, y'all better get your doggy bags out now. Get your ticks out of there. Okay.
Would you give us a sense of how this record came together?
Well, basically, we were off, you know, off the road for a couple of years, and it was the type of record that we had to put out, because we're still going through litigation with the record companies and everything and reorganizing the thing. It was a record that I put out on my own first solo album. And I was trying new things because, you know, we didn't have nothing to worry about whether we got played or not. So I tried some different type things. And so Atomic Dog was just the kind of life I probably was living at the moment. I don't know intellectually really what made me do it, but I think we was getting felt dogged out by the record companies about our whole lifestyle or whatever was going on in the streets. Since we weren't working, you know, you tend to get back into all of the party things. And I think I was feeling dogged out, probably was dogging myself out at the time. But I just know I walked in the studio one day and just started singing. I didn't even know what I was singing about. And that's the way it came. And most of our songs come like that. We make sense out of it later. Somebody come along and say, did you mean so-and-so and so-and-so? And if it sounds real hip, I say, yeah, that's what I mean.
This is George Clinton's Atomic Dog.
Yeah, this is a story of famous dog. For the dog that chases its tail, house dog, street dog. Dogs of the world unite, dancing dogs. Yeah, kind dog. Funky dogs. Nasty dogs.
Compete. wow, wow, yippee yo, yippee yay, bow, wow, yippee yo, yippee yay.
Untied dog in a telematic society. Ain't your average.
That's George Clinton's Atomic Dog. How did you start moving from singing to also producing and doing these really far-out rhythm tracks? I know you were always producing. You produced the Parliament's records, but it really became like a specialty of yours.
Well, after I realized that it was going to take more than one group to survive and, you know, and make it, any one group, it could be stopped any kind of ways or just be stopped because they're not good enough. But I think if you have a number of outlets for your stuff, when one style is saying that you're over with, another one will be saying that, oh, this is the new thing. So not only did Parliament Funkadelic, we did Bootsy, you know, as an offshoot to Brides, the Horny Horns, everybody that was in the band. So that gave me a lot of different outlets because so many members in the band can write and would have liked to have their own group, but they didn't want the hassles. So it was easy for me to utilize all the people in the band, and it kept my outlet wide open. Like right now, we got Funkadelic just released on MCA. My son is on, Tracy is on the Warner Brothers. I'm doing a guy called Babbling Kababy, and his record is like really funky. It'll be out pretty soon. And so I'm always continually cutting music and trying to keep another thing happening, because when they say it's over with this planned obsolescence trip, you know, if you ain't got but that one record, you got a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, you not only have a lot of different bands that you've created and produced, you also have different alter egos that you've performed under, like Dr. Funkenstein.
Dr. Funkenstein, Mr. Wiggles, Sir Nose.
Would you describe one of your alter egos for our listeners who haven't seen you perform?
Okay, well, Sir Nose, you know, I would never dance. I should never dance. Nobody can make me dance. I don't even make love. That voice, you know, harmonized on it, made it real high. But the voice was actually, I was imitating one of the guys that used to work in the barbershop, or used to come to the barbershop all the time. He had, you know, all the girls liked him. He was real cool, but he, as far as I was concerned, he was crazy. I mean, this dude stabs his car, you know, but he was a fun dude, and everybody liked him, and he was cool, but at the same time, he was a nut. And when I told him, like, you know, maybe 6-7 years ago that I had been imitating him with that voice, it tickled him because, you know, he's a grown man now and he remembered those things. But most of the voice, I usually use a character out of the barbershop because, you know, the thing in the barbershop is to get up and tell lies. When I saw Sugar Ray fight Joe Louis in 27, Richard Pryor always do it. Those are the kind of things that always happen in barbershops. And I found that they work good on record. You know, like, make my funk the P-funk. I want my funk uncut. All of those are, you know, slang that's used, like, in the streets or in the barbershop. And you find more of it in the barbershop than you do anywhere. So a lot of the characters were based on people who I know their personality was penetrating when I did it. Dr. Funkenstein was like a FM disc jockey. WEFUNK, We Funk, home of the extraterrestrial brothers, bringing you music to get your together by... You know, and all of those things were like just different places I know that was penetrating. And I knew that the DJ was missing off of radio. They had started doing the cartridge thing. So the personalities that you used to hear on the radio, like, let me see. Attention on radio station jocks. You got to be serious slamming on my box. Because when I try my best to get into the decibels up so high that my neighbors call the cops. So when the thing get to tweaking, you know the groove is peaking. I mean harder than a cinder block. Okay, I know you know what I mean. I keep a party tweaking on my record machine. You know, and those kind of things, or those kind of jocks is like missing off of radio now. And, you know, and I figured, well, if I put this on Mothership Connection, it was the right thing at that time. And it's what most rappers tell me now that they got, or they learned rapping from,
mm-hmm.
the Mothership Connection album.
You know, you're, I think, 48 now, nearing in on 50.
Just got to 48.
Okay. Do you ever worry, though, about if your image will have to change as you get a little older, like toned down from the kind of extravagance and sexual innuendo, you know, in the performances?
Oh, well, I changed. That changed a long time ago to sexual innuendos in you outdoes. And that, you know, it's redirected from, like, I wouldn't go to the front stage and flirt with the 13-year-old girls, but I was still probably say something really funky or dirty. You can always change that to fit whatever age, mm-hmm. you know, and it's all the same. But I don't worry about that. As long as I don't be walking around here looking like this with no possible way of hit records, you know, if I don't have no possible way of hit records, then I told everybody around me, make sure I get rid of this Baby Jane look. You hip to Baby Jane, right? You know, so if I don't have no possible, and as long as I got some kind of reason to think that I got a record coming out, I don't mind looking different or weird or whatever, because to me it's only a style. But if it don't look like I'm ever going to put a record out, I tell everybody, remind me to cut this off my head.
You know, when we were setting up this interview with you, we found out that you don't have a telephone. And I couldn't imagine why.
I haven't had one for about 10 years. The mothership will get in touch with you if it's need to be in touch with somebody. You don't really realize how much you don't need a lot of things until you... I mean, I know most people think I'm crazy then, for real, but the majority of things that you depend on, like, as lifeblood, is not really that.
I regret that we're out of time. It's really been wonderful to have you here. Thank you.
Good.
Thank you very much for doing the interview. Thanks for being here.
Our interview with George Clinton was recorded in 1989. A new album is scheduled for release in September. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.